Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary, and this is Owen Tracy recording at 1:23 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 22nd, and I thought that because today is the big picture long-term video for the various different asset classes, and the last one before Christmas, let me just take this opportunity to wish you all the very happiest Christmas and prosperous New Year. I'll be picking up the service again on Wednesday. Well, when we look at the German sovereign curve, it still goes from bottom left to top right. It's certainly far from inverted, but the numbers are rather odd. You have to go all the way out to 7-year maturities before they go back above the 0% level. Now, what I think is important is that you can see what the ticker is. It's YCGT, and what that suggests is that this is the yield curve that they're using is a what's called a continuation chart. So they're just stringing together all the individual yields for the bonds over time. When we look at the bond futures page, then we can see that when we look at the yields, that you have to go out to 30 years before you get a positive yield. And then the Bund and the Bobl are both still in negative territory, whereas the Schatz is in positive territory, but only as of today. The interesting thing about shorting bonds is that it's a rather tricky process because you have to pay the interest rate. And when the bond yield is negative, you should be receiving the interest rate if you have a short position rather than paying it. Therefore, why would anybody not have a short position in these bonds? And most particularly, if we look at, for example, the 5-year, which has been negative for the yield has been negative for over 2 years already. This was a meaningful upward dynamic in terms of the yield this week. And this is a yield that has base formation characteristics, and there is a mild upward bias within that base in those yields over the last 18 months. And this has been a profound downtrend that has been going on now for a long time. No one thought that it was even remotely possible that yields could ever go below zero, and yet they've been below zero for much of the last two, and if you go even shorter on the curve, 3 years. And this has a massively distorting effect, that we have a condition where the government bonds for a significant number of countries are in negative territory. There is a lot of money that is still tied up in government bond yields that are trading negatively. And Switzerland is another example of that. Swiss 10-year yields have been negative for a lot of the time since the beginning of 2015. They've popped very briefly above zero on a couple of occasions this year, but been knocked right back, and now the yield is starting to firm once more. But when we look at this trend, and if we were to take the labels off, well, what we have is a type 2 bottom with a massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend with a period of right-hand extension. It's not such a great prediction that eventually this is going to be resolved on the upside. And we are, I think this is a particularly important time to be thinking about these considerations, because what is gaining increasing acceptance is that we're in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, where just about all global economies are expanding right now. Everywhere from China to Japan to Australia to Latin America and North America and Europe are all expanding. And obviously not at the same pace, but there aren't recessions going on. Even, for example, in Brazil, where they definitely had a recession, but they're coming out of that recession right now. And what that means is that because we have synchronized global economic expansion, then there isn't quite the same need for synchronized global monetary expansion. So we're starting to see that central banks are peeling away from this unquestioning commitment to increasing the supply of money and, quote-unquote, to do whatever is necessary to avoid deflation. The Federal Reserve is already beginning to reduce the size of its balance sheet, and it has been doing so in a very modest fashion. The peak in the balance sheet was just over $4.5 trillion back in January of 2015, and it's just a bit less than 4.45. So they've taken $6 billion out of circulation in the last almost three full years. So to say that this is a modest pace of decline is not an underestimate. But it will pick up pace because they have got a lot of debt that needs to be refinanced next year. And just retiring some of that debt is going to be one of the conditions that will make refinancing the rest of it that little bit easier. And we know that the USA is also raising interest rates. And Canada is also beginning to raise interest rates. And when we look at their government bonds, we're going to see a pretty similar story, that this week we saw a meaningful pop in the yield, again from the region of the trend mean in this occasion, and yields have been moving higher and in fact have doubled since the end of 2016. So when we look at that on the really long-term chart, then it's not yet categorical that the downtrend has been broken. But we do have a progression of higher reaction lows, and as long as that remains the case, we wouldn't give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And considering just how long these yields have been trending lower for, when this downtrend is eventually broken, then this will represent the end of a secular bull market in bonds and the beginning of a secular bear market. The dislocations that the distortions that have been created by synchronized global monetary expansion are going to be tested as we see an increasing number of central banks beginning to change their strategies. And the total of central bank balance sheets right now is pretty close to $20 trillion. But the onus for continuing that expansion is falling on successively fewer central banks. The Federal Reserve is raising interest rates and reducing the size of its balance sheet. The ECB is beginning to taper. The UK reversed an earlier interest rate cut and now is back to a neutral position. But the ECB is going to be tapering from January, and that would suggest that they are going to stop adding new money in by September of next year. The only country that is still engaged in a process of both fiscal and monetary expansion is Japan. And when we look at their government bonds, well, they're not negative. In fact, they've been trading above the zero bound for most of this year. So it is Germany. It is the Bund, the Bobl and the Schatz where we see some of the greatest risk, because they have benefited enormously from the ECB's largesse. It has created this rather interesting condition where the yield on 10-year Italian bonds is in the region of 1.91%, and the yield on the 10-year US Treasury is closer to 2.4. So Italy has got better funding conditions than the USA at the present moment. And for a market like Italy to be able to achieve that is really an incredible testament to the success that the ECB's program has had, that they have reduced the funding costs for countries that have got enormous quantities of debt to levels that even the largest economy in the world cannot achieve. Well, this is a silly situation. It's something that is not going to persist indefinitely. And when the ECB eventually begins to reduce the size of its balance sheet, then we're going to have a problem, because the funding costs for all European sovereigns are going to rise, and some of them are better able to handle that than others. The DAX index in Germany has been rallying in a similar manner to, for I think, more more similar to the Russell 2000 in the USA than the S&P or the Dow Jones or the Nasdaq. But it is now susceptible to some mean reversion. The fact that you've had very low funding costs, and this isn't simply a European phenomenon, but it is something that has been through all markets, has the primary conduit through which that those very low funding costs have been able to get into the stock market has been through stock or share buybacks. And share buybacks are generally cyclical trends, because when funding is cheap, and then companies will just go out and borrow money and start paying back their share, buying back their shares. When funding costs rise, it's usually as we head into a recession, and then they start to come back down again. But because funding is high, then companies will not be borrowing it to buy back their shares, and therefore it removes a fundamental, I think, strut from the bull market. When we think about that, the role of these kinds of conditions, because this is not a valuation consideration, that if companies behaved like investors and were buying low and selling high, then what that would suggest is that they wouldn't be buying their shares the higher they go. But that's exactly what they do. So they're not looking at it from a valuation perspective. They are simply a victim, or they are subject to the laws of financial engineering. And that's an earnings agnostic way of approaching the market. What you also have is the evolution of earnings agnostic strategies in the ETF market. Now, the amount of money that's been flowing into ETFs is pretty incredible over the last year and a half. And this is a lot of money. Where we see that the ETF holdings have risen to over 350 million, excuse me, billion in new money committed this year on a monthly, so these are yearly net inflows. So when we think about it on those basis, who are the companies that benefit most from this? Well, they're usually the larger companies, because the vast majority of indices are market cap weighted. And when a company like Amazon does so very well in a year, and what does that do? It drags the market higher. So when Amazon rises, for example, from $800 to almost $1,200 in a year, up almost 50%, then that has a pull effect on the market. On the other hand, when something like Under Armour pulls back violently in a year, then where it falls from close to $30 in January to a low quite recently, just above 10, then the biggest impact that it has on the stock market is in January, because it has a bigger weighting on the index. Now, it isn't really that. So then, therefore, when you are buying an index, what you're getting are a focus on the large cap performers. And that's a very concentrated way of participating in the market, despite the fact that buying the index is sold to people as being diversified. But it's not diversified if the index is market cap weighted. It's only diversified if you are buying the index on an equal weighted basis, but that is not how the vast majority of people are investing. And what it contributes to is, again, an earnings agnostic way of participating in the market. Because if people are buying the index and they're concentrating on the large shares, what they want is momentum, and they're not concentrating on fundamentals. Then when we look at the strategy that a lot of people have been participating in this year, which is to short the VIX, then that has worked out very well. By shorting the VIX, what you are in fact doing is selling time, and you are betting that the options will expire before they can be exercised. And since the majority of options expire before they're exercised, that's how people are making money. They have turned the short VIX strategy into a yield product. But again, this is a strategy that is 100% influenced by the flow of money into the system. That one of the reasons that volatility has been so low is because of the quantity of money that has been flowing into ETFs. And with that money coming in, people buying all day, all week, all month, because the S&P, for example, has not had a pullback of more than 80 points in more than a year, well, that's a very comforting statistic. And what it suggests is that this very inert environment on the VIX index is again a function of this earnings agnostic strategy. Then we have the fact that the correlations between stock markets and bond markets have been very tight for much of the last year. And what that has contributed to is the triumph of the risk parity strategy, where risk in stocks can be laid off against risk in the bond market. But government bond yields are starting to rise. And if that is the case, then that is going to have an influence on those risk parity strategies. Even the UK gilt, which had spent most of this week in negative territory, in fact pushed up today, or excuse me, pushed up yesterday, and is now back above the trend mean. And what this suggests is that when we look at all these government bond charts, what we're presented with is commonality in terms of the term structure of the market, because yields are firming right across maturities, but then yields are also firming across issuers. And this is a change. We're getting a high degree of commonality where it is looking increasingly likely that base formations are going to be resolved on the upside in 2018. And that's when we need to spend a particular amount of time looking at high yield spreads, because high yield spreads have done nothing this year. They've been trading in a very inert fashion for all of 2017. Well, when they eventually break higher, that is going to represent a headwind for the equity markets. And we have a very recent example of that. It was back in 2014. In the middle of 2014, that high yield spread chart rallied to break its progression of lower rally highs and then moved above the trend mean. And it was back in 2014 that we saw the first big pullback on the S&P 500. If we look here, that this was a pullback larger than anything we'd seen in the context of the trend since the end of 2012. It was part of the softening up process. After that, the index lost momentum, and we had some acute bouts of volatility in 2015 and early 2016. And it was during that time that high yield spreads were starting to rise. Well, we have had an even more consistent advance recently, and the pace of that advance has picked up, and it has most particularly picked up on the Dow Jones Industrials, where the pace of this advance is much quicker than we've seen in the last decade, and in fact, it's faster than we've seen at any time in the last 20 odd years. So a lot of good news has been priced in, and the index is trading in the region of 25,000, which is an area where it's not inconceivable that we should get some pause and consolidation. Well, considering that the index has gone up not far off not far off 5,000 points this year, then the potential for some pause and consolidation is certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility. What a lot of people will be looking at is, if it does pull back, how much will it pull back? Because the size of the reactions has been getting progressively smaller. This most recent reaction from the, let's call it the 24,530 level, was only a few hundred points. And each of the ranges is above the last. So this index does not have a great deal of room in which to consolidate and still remain very consistent, and a lot of people will probably be looking at, again, this 24,500 level. Eventually, it will pull back by more than that. That will represent an inconsistency, and it will increase the potential that we're moving into a period where some of the overbought condition is going to be unwound. This index has been propelled higher by enthusiasm about tax cuts, and the enthusiasm about tax cuts has been manifested in the market by money flowing into ETFs, which has contributed to the acceptance of this earnings agnostic way of thinking about the markets. All the people that are really interested in earnings, the fundamental analysts who are looking at the PE ratio and thinking that it is at levels that are rather extraordinary and that we haven't seen in a long time. And that is particularly the case for the cyclically adjusted PE ratio. Well, eventually, what we're going to get is, and let me see if I can pull up the multiple.com. There we go, the multiple PE ratio. So, when we look at this particular chart, this is S&P 500 earnings, and those earnings are at an all-time high. If earnings continue to move higher, then the PE ratio should at least pause from going up in a dynamic manner from here. And what that would suggest is that we are still in a period of time where valuations can expand. They are at their second highest in history, and the highest point was back in 1999. This is not a timing index. Rather, what this tells us is that valuations are increasing and that the vast majority of people don't care. When we look at the fact that you have this earnings agnostic strategy, then the triumph of that strategy tells us we're in the latter stages of a medium-term environment. The fact that the market has begun to accelerate tells us we're in the third psychological perception stages of this medium-term bull market. There are other indications that also contribute to that conclusion. Well, one is that bond yields are starting to rise and that we're starting to see the performance of the energy sector and the resources sector, which are classically cyclical. There was a time when you would have lumped in the technology sector as also a cyclical part of the market, but I don't think that that's correct any longer. Most particularly for those big US companies, because they have increasingly adopted a subscription strategy. One of the reasons that technology would have been cyclical previously is because they had lumpy cash flows, that they were subject to the business cycle and they were subject to their own product cycles. And what that contributed to was boom and bust, and in terms of their earnings. But by adopting a subscription model, I think it is now more appropriate to look at some of these technology companies more in the context of the consumer staples market rather than the cyclical sector. Now, oil prices went through $65 today, and there is a big reason why. And it has to do with investors in shale oil and unconventional oil projects wanting to get some of their money back. This is, I think, indicative of private equity beginning to ascertain that funding costs are beginning to rise, that we are in the latter stages of an expansion, so therefore it is time to start raising some cash out of their investments. And we're seeing that in the energy markets, where they are going out to the unconventional suppliers and saying stop drilling. That start producing, that they want to get some of their money out of their investments. And what that has contributed to is a slower pickup in supply from some of those sources from the USA. Excuse me, I'm just taking a drink of water. Well, when we think about it in those terms, then oil prices can go a bit higher. But the other way of thinking about it is that if private equity firms are getting some money out of their investments, then they also think that we're in the latter stages of a bull market. I was reminded of that today. I continue to get rather a lot of mail from Blue Apron, and they're sending things through my door at least every week, telling me that I really need to try this out. Well, that IPO'd in July, and the share is now a fraction of where it was then, and it's another one of these companies that has tried to leap onto the subscription model bandwagon. Another one is Graze, who have been inundating my mail with temptations for sugary snacks. And what this suggests is that you're getting these companies that are being listed on the stock market because their founders want to get some money out. And I think that that is also the case with the Snap IPO, which is also at a fraction of its original IPO price. Now, when you start to see private equity firms getting their money off the table, then that's an additional indication that we're in the latter stages of an expansion. And what happens in terms of the high yield spreads, I think, is the canary in the coal mine, and which is why I'm watching Tesla quite closely, because Tesla is an incredibly high profile company, and they don't have a PE ratio because they don't have any earnings. And you can go out a couple of years and they don't have a PE ratio because they're not expected to have any earnings if you look even 12 months out. And this is a company that has been able to move from $25 to $325 in the space of 5 years by losing money hand over fist. And they have some enormous challenges, whether they can get their production up to scale in time before they run out of money. At some point, high yield spreads are going to begin to rise, and the sources of funding that the company has access to will dry up. Well, they've gone to their equity investors, they've gone for loans, and they've even been asking for the subscriptions or deposits from people who want to buy their cars. And they've been able to gather money in lots of different ways, but the success of the business has so far been driven on access to cheap credit. If Tesla sustains a move below $300, then that will be a canary in the coal mine that has stopped singing. And I think that that is would be another indication that we are in the latter stages of this bull market. Now, this remains a consistent advance, and as long as the advance remains consistent, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And when we cast our mind or our eye around the global stock market environment, well, what we're seeing is an increasing number of markets that are breaking on the upside. The FTSE 100 moved to a new high in here today. So, what this looks like when we look at the long-term chart is a first step above the long-term base, that the index ranged for 16 years, and now it has broken out. And it has obviously been helped by the fact that it is jammed full of internationally oriented companies and the relative weakness of the pound. But the reasons are, in many respects, can be argued about, but the fact is that it is trading at new all-time highs, and that this has I think it has the hallmark of a new bull market. When we look at the Japanese market, the TOPIX has been ranging below the 1800 level since 1992, and it is now in the process of breaking higher. This is the end of a secular period of stagnation for Japan. And there is, I think, a very important point that has to be made. It's that Japan has been trying to foment inflation for what must feel like forever and failed. And one has to ask the question whether they were doing it wrong or whether they could possibly ever have achieved, considering that we were in a period of disinflation that has got very few parallels in human history. And if we're moving out of that period of disinflation and back into an inflationary global economy, well, I think it does stand to reason that Japan could be the one where we start to see evidence of that inflation coming back most acutely. And considering that the TOPIX Banks Index is today not far off where it was back in 2003, I think is something that is really worth considering. This is an index that could benefit enormously from higher margins if interest rates begin to rise, or if we move back into an inflationary bias on the global economy. And it has just broken above the 200 level. And as long as it is sustaining that move above 200, I think we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. There is ample potential for Japanese banks to outperform against this background. And I think that it is one of the markets that we need to pay closest attention to for the 2008 year. Excuse me. A year of 2018, excuse me. If that is indeed the case, then the potential is that the kinds of companies that do well from an inflationary environment are those that both pay dividends and have the capability of increasing those dividends in line with inflation. That falls, I think, very squarely on Dividend Aristocrats, and also on the kinds of companies that we consider autonomies. So those are the kinds of companies that should do well. That's also part of the reason why the Dow Jones has been doing so well, that it is in at least in part an inflation hedge. Now, the big question, though, is when we start to see these interest rates rising, it's going to represent a big question about which kinds of companies are, as Warren Buffett says, who's been swimming naked. What that could contribute to is some companies going bust, and others that we could move into a much more volatile trading period. And then we have to start thinking about where are we in terms of the secular trend. And the Dow Gold Ratio is a very handy way of looking at that, because it peaked in 1999, and we had more than a decade of outperformance by gold. And gold hit a meaningful peak in 2011, and the Dow Jones has improved and has been trending higher since. Well, it isn't going to go up in a straight line indefinitely, but what it does suggest is that we could be in a secular bull market for equities for perhaps the next 20 years, or not far off it. What that would suggest is that the next time we do have a recession, then it's likely to be really quite a phenomenal buying opportunity for the long term. And it also suggests that equity markets are one of the best hedges against inflation, because companies have the ability to raise their dividends. So that could be the animating factor behind the growth of stock market prices. Now, when we think about it in those terms, then what happens with the commodity complex? Well, gold tends to do best when interest rates are rising faster than the central bank is raising interest rates. We don't have that condition right now, and that has resulted in the price going sideways for nearly 2 years already. Now, the price is firming in here today, and it is closing above the trend mean for the first time in 3 weeks, not least because of the pullback that we've had in Bitcoin. Well, it really does need to follow through on the upside next week. If we can see gold prices trading back above $1,300 by the end of the year, then that would break the downward bias of the last few months, and it would suggest that the likelihood is we're going to get a move back up towards $1,400. And what that also suggests is that gold could get reassessed as a safe haven. not least as the government bond market is now beginning to move higher. I think another important chart that I've been monitoring for a long time is the total return on 10-year treasuries. And when I zoom in on that just for the last decade, then what we have here is an index that has broken below the trend mean, that has evolving type 3 top characteristics, and has been going sideways already for over 3 years. Now, if we see these lows from 2016 getting taken out around that 2050 level, so it does have another 60 odd points to fall before it does that, then we would have top formation completion. And when that happens, then that is going to have a knock-on effect for just about everything else. That will contribute to a more difficult environment on stocks and potentially also on commodities. And we will most likely have a recessionary environment that we need to pay attention to. When we think about what are the things that will take us up and out of the next recession, then there are certain factors that are not related to price. And one of those is technological innovation. The pace of technological innovation continues to advance, and it happens independently of the price action. And that is something that really has to be taken into account. And I think that the people who are investing in Bitcoin probably need to remember that as well. Bitcoin has gone up like a rocket this year, and it has pulled back very violently over the last four sessions. Now, it is well off its low in here today, but this is a massive reaction against the prevailing uptrend. It is a clear type 2 top characteristic. A question that we get at the chart seminar almost every time is, what markets does your method work best in? And the answer is simple enough. It works best in the markets where you have an imbalance between supply and demand. And we've had a massive one in Bitcoin. What people need to remember about Bitcoin is that the success or otherwise of the blockchain technology on which it's based will happen regardless of what the price is. And I think as people are become more acquainted with it and come down from the hysteria that we've had over the last month, then they will start to consider these sorts of questions. What this also helps to highlight is that there is technological innovation going on. That companies like Cisco are benefiting from the evolution of 5G. And that rollout of infrastructure, the adoption of a subscription model for their businesses, is helping the share to break up and out of this long-term base formation. But 5G is the kind of technology that will be required to really fuel autonomous vehicles, the mass transit solutions that would make Waze part of every, the Google app Waze, part of every car, will help to drive the Internet of Things, because as the number of sensors increases, the bandwidth that they're going to require is also going to increase. Then we have the evolution of the space sector, where nano satellites are becoming progressively cheaper and more capable and lasting longer, that they're way smaller, that you can fit hundreds in the nose cone of a rocket, whereas before you could fit one satellite. It will make internet free for everyone, everywhere. In other words, it will do to the global economy what happened in India just over the last year. India got 4G. Whoops, that's the wrong chart. India got 4G in late 2016, and the stock market has done pretty much nothing but go up since. It's been going up in a relatively modest pace, but it is going up nonetheless. Reliance Industries, which owns that 4G network, has gone up a lot more. And by giving access to the internet to people and most particularly in India, where you have such a huge population of illiterate people, where they can interact with their mobile phone at very attractive costs, with their voice and their fingerprint, and they don't need to be able to read to engage with banking or online purchases. What that does is it massively enhances the productivity of the economy. It brings hundreds of millions of people into the digital economy that would never have been able to do so before. And the prospect that we have in the next decade of nanosatellites literally becoming pinpricks of stars in on all over the world, that is going to create an internet revolution for billions of people. And where that's likely to have the greatest effect is in places like Africa, where you have internet connection and you have mobile phones, but it is still spotty over much of the continent. These are the kinds of things that will drive innovation and drive growth over the long term. So you have 5G, you have internet access, and then you have the rise of biotechnology, where the invention of CRISPR gene editing technology is another massive enabler. And the who owns the patent has not quite been settled yet, but that doesn't really matter from the perspective of the growth of the technology, because it has gone from nowhere a few years ago to being used in every biotechnology lab in the world within just the last 18 months. And it reduces the cost and multiplies the efficacy of gene editing, which is going to lead to a step change in innovation in the biotechnology sector. And that's part of the reason that the biotech sector has been trending higher, albeit in a jerky manner, for a lot of this year already. And I suspect that that is likely to continue. Well, again, this is another, these are the kinds of changes that are happening out there in the world that simply do not are not going to be affected by price action. So whenever we have the next recession, these things, these trends are going to persist. There is, for example, nothing that is going to stop the billions of people that are in their early teens today being 10 years older in 10 years' time. And that is when billions of people will be entering their most productive phases. So the rise of the global consumer also represents this profound change where we have billions of people that are going to be entering the global economy, and their demand for everything is going to increase. So then we have energy, and the evolution of the autonomous vehicle and battery technology is progressing very rapidly. The prize is so large that capital is flowing into this sector, because whoever can come up with a more efficient battery that charges faster and has more energy density without impacting range, then the prize for coming up with that solution is literally the size of the global energy markets. And it isn't a question of if, but rather when we get that change. And generally speaking, it is when you get new forms of energy then you can get these massive leaps in human development. And there is the real possibility that the evolution of batteries, the evolution of solar technology and renewables, the eventual commercialization of fusion, are all out there in the future and drivers of a secular bull market. So when we think about the potential, there is enormous potential for additional upside. And the way that the political environment is evolving is contributing to the inflationary bias and the rise of interest rates, because the the results that people have got from the status quo over the last 30 years has meant that middle classes have been hollowed out in a number of developed economies, and that has helped to create consumer classes in much of the rest of the world. What people are looking for now is a more equitable distribution of living standards rather than money. And that is something that I think is going to change the way that the global economy is set up. It could lead to protectionism. It could lead to a backlash against globalization. What we're seeing with the rise of what some people are calling populism or xenophobia or racism is more appropriately called a reaction against the status quo. It's being manifested in different countries in different ways. So in the USA, we are getting a fiscal stimulus, which is a pro-cyclical policy to try and put more money in people's pockets. Quite whether it succeeds or not is largely beside the point when it comes to the fact that it is a symptom of this reaction against the status quo. In the UK, the reaction has been to leave the EU. And within Europe, then the reaction has been against immigration, and it has been against the overpowering nature of the sovereign. So we've had Catalonia revolting, and again just this week voting for separatists. Then there is the real possibility that Berlusconi could be the next prime minister of Italy, despite the fact that he is an octogenarian and has been through numerous scandals. I don't think we have time in this broadcast to go over all of them. But again, what we're seeing is that this reaction against the status quo is just being manifested in different ways in different places. And eventually, that is going to the answer, regardless of which way it's approached, is that people want more money and they want better living standards, and they will keep voting for polarizing characters until they get what they want. And what that suggests is that we are not yet close to the end of this rise of what some people call populism, but rather at the beginning. And the partial parallels that we have between the conditions that we get in different countries right now and Plato's Republic are hard to miss. Well, against that background, then, we are moving more towards inflation, because that at least masks the lower living standards that people have. The rise of the subscription model has been enormously successful for investors, but it is now also being challenged by this upheaval against the status quo. So when I look at the global economy, what I see is that we are at a maturing phase for this medium-term bull market, but that the bull market is still intact. That there is a short-term risk of pause and consolidation, not least because we're at the end of the year. But then when I look at the secular bull market, that there are plenty of reasons to be bullish, and that any significant pullback we get, not least if it's part of a recession, will be a buying opportunity. The best way to have some money available when you do get that environment is to become vigilant for lead indicators for trouble, and to be very conscious of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend-ending characteristics. And right now, we do not have a great deal of that, other than accelerations on the Dow Jones. And what that suggests is that the Dow Jones is more susceptible than most other indices to some pause and consolidation. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and again, wish all the best to all of you.